Okay, so we have a big picture now of the Buddha's life, kind of from beginning to end, some major phases of his life, some major events, some places. And Steve and I decided that something that might be nice would be to go into more depth about a few points in his life that might suggest and you could connect with, just in terms of his teachings and himself as a being, a human being. So I had two stories that have always been important to me, and I had no trouble picking them. And I'm starting with the one that is first chronologically in his life. And it takes place when he's still Siddhartha or Siddhartha. He's not the Buddha yet. He's about 36 years old, and he is very near a small village called Bodh Gaya in northern India, at the east end of the Ganges Plain. Now he's been seeking, he has renounced his home and his family, and he's been seeking a true path for 6 years. And at this point, he looks like the sculpture that you saw, that Steve showed, where he has been following concentration traditions and ascetic traditions. And he has starved himself, basically, and he's really at the point of near death. We might say he's hit rock bottom. And he says in the suttas, "I've spent 6 years like a man trying to tie the air into knots." He's in the seeking stage, and he's not sure what he's looking for. He's tried following teachers of concentration practice, and he's surpassed each in wisdom and meditative accomplishments. He's experienced the four jhana levels of meditation, including the highest level of perfect equanimity and awareness. But he says, "By clenching my teeth and pressing my tongue against the roof of my mouth to beat down, constrain and crush my mind with my awareness, unmuddled mindfulness was established, but the experience didn't last. It didn't invade my mind and it didn't remain. So it was transitory." So then he took up with the five ascetics and tried that path. And he said, he's contemplating where he is right now. And he says that he's feeling sensations of painful, racking, piercing feelings due to striving. And he's not yet found the end of suffering despite all his efforts. So he asks the question, might there be another way to enlightenment? And he doesn't know the answer. And it's going against all the wisdom, spiritual wisdom of the time to ask that question. But that question opened him up to a memory of his experience under the rose apple tree when he was probably 9 years old. And it says in the sutta, "I thought of a time when my Sakyan father," that's his clan, "was working, and I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree, quite secluded from sensual desires, secluded from unwholesome things. I had entered upon and abode in the first meditation, which is accompanied by thinking and exploring with happiness and pleasure born of seclusion." Now, his father, Suddhodana, presided over the ceremony of the first plowing of the fields. And the priests, so these would have been Hindu priests, were reciting the Holy Scriptures. The whole village was attending. Suddhodana plowed the first row of the field as the crowd cheered. Then, following Suddhodana's lead, the farmers hitched their water buffaloes to their plows and began to divide the rich earth into neat furrows. The villagers brought refreshments, and there was singing and dancing, but Siddhartha was sitting down with his legs crossed, meditating. He now recalled how refreshing and peaceful those moments had been. And he thought, might that be the way to enlightenment? And then he knew this was the way to enlightenment. He had discovered the middle way. Sensual grasping wasn't the route to happiness, but neither was suppression of sensual pleasure. In his 6 years of seeking with great effort the key to enlightenment, he'd lost touch with that simple happiness born of relaxed contemplation. But then he noticed fear arising in response to his memory of that pleasure. Because he'd been conditioned through his ascetic practices to associate pleasure with unwholesomeness. But he then discerned that this pleasure was different. He thought, no, I'm not afraid of such pleasure, for it has nothing to do with sensual pleasure and desires and unwholesome things. This was the happiness that one of our Thai forest tradition teachers, Ajahn Chah, would later call the happiness of the Buddha. And Ajahn Chah says, try to be mindful and let things take their natural course. Then your mind will become still in any surroundings, like a still forest pool. This is the happiness of the Buddha. So this is really an important point in the Buddha's life. He is connecting with joy as a foundation of the spiritual path, and not the joy that is sensual pleasure. So there's like two kinds of joy, two kinds of happiness, which is really important as part of the Buddha's teaching. And another thing is that he is seeing the value of looking within for answers to his quest. And Jack Kornfield, one of the Western Buddhist teachers, founding teachers, talks about the wholesomeness of our childhood experience of life. And he says one of the major sources of our spiritual wholeness, sources of our spiritual consciousness is found in our earliest life. We experience the freshness of seeing, feeling, and touching the world for the first time, the immediate physical presence of our senses and our own needs, and trust in what we know and feel is essential to finding our spiritual ground in later practice. So turning inward and finding our true self is a part of our path. And this is something that Buddha recognized when this memory came up to him. So finally, Siddhartha returned to the present, and he realized it's not possible to obtain the pleasure with the body, a body so excessively emaciated. How could he feel joy? So he decides, suppose I eat some solid food. At this time, he was only eating, I think, the juice squeezed from peas and beans or something like that. So he did eat some boiled rice and bread at this point. And his it just so happens the suttas say that the five ascetics, colleagues of his, turned away from him in disgust. They thought that he'd fallen off the path, but we know that he had not. And soon after this, Siddhartha sat down under the Bodhi tree at Bodh Gaya, and when he got up, he had become the Buddha. So I think this story is so remarkable because it shows how the Buddha discovered the middle way, not by some elaborate philosophical analysis, but by means of a different kind of thought, an intuitive thought that went through his heart back to his childhood memory. And it was like a still small voice that the Quakers refer to. He trusted his own direct experience and questioned the rightness of the established spiritual paths of the time. And he asked the question, might there be another way? Which opened him up to the unknown. And from that, an answer came to him from within. So that is the first story I offer to you, to see how that connects with you and your path and what you know of the Buddha and your practice. Now, the second one is quite different, and it's during another period in his life. It's at the stage where he has awakened. He's the Buddha now, and he's back in the world teaching and helping others find their way. So at this point, he is at the other end of the Ganges Valley. He's near Savatthi or Shravasti, which is near his childhood home. It's not too far from where he grew up. And we saw pictures of this place. This is the place where he spent most of his life, in Jetta's Grove, or the monastery that was built for him by a very wealthy follower and merchant beneficiary, well, not benefactor, benefactor. So he spent, as Steve already said, he spent most of the rainy seasons there. And this happened, it says in the suttas, in the 20th rainy season after the Buddha's awakening. So he's about halfway between his awakening and his death. And he is doing his daily going out for alms. And the story begins as many of the suttas do. Thus I heard, once when the Blessed One was living in Savatthi, a bandit had appeared in the realm of King Pasenadi of Kosala. He was called Angulimala, that is to say, finger necklace. And he was murderous, bloody-handed, given to blows and violence, and merciless to all living beings. Villages, towns, and districts were laid waste by him. He went on murdering people, and he wore their fingers in a necklace. So this is the serial killer that Steve was talking about. The Buddha had heard about Angulimala, but that didn't keep the Buddha from going out for alms when he was staying at Jetavana. The locals warned, don't take that road, monk. Men have come by that road in bands of 10, 20, 30, and even 40, but they've all fallen into the hands of Angulimala. But the Buddha took that road anyway, and sure enough, Angulimala was waiting, and he saw the Buddha walking along, and he said, it is wonderful, it is marvelous indeed. Now this monk comes along, alone and unaccompanied. Why should I not take this monk's life? And seizing his sword and shield, he went in pursuit of the Blessed One. The Buddha continued walking at his normal pace. Angulimala chased after him, but no matter how fast Angulimala ran, he couldn't catch up with the Buddha, who walked on steadily. It's said that the Buddha used some of his supernormal powers, which he was known for. He was also known for his keen perception of how each person needed to be taught, and he had recognized the potential in Angulimala's heart to change his ways. Angulimala called out, "Stop, monk, stop!" The Buddha replied, "I have stopped, Angulimala. Now you stop also." Angulimala stopped to think. He couldn't understand why the Blessed One would say he had stopped when he was clearly walking ahead. So he questioned the Buddha. "O monk, what is the meaning of it? How is it you have stopped and I have not?" And the Buddha replied, "Angulimala, I have stopped forever, forswearing violence to every living being, but you have no restraint towards anything. So that is why I have stopped and you have not." Upon hearing these words, Angulimala exclaimed, "At long last, a sage I can revere." And he swore to renounce all evil on the spot. He threw his sword and weapons aside. He bent down to the Buddha's feet and asked for the going forth. In other words, to become a monk. And the Buddha replied, "Come, bhikkhu." And so that is how Angulimala, the horrible bandit and murderer, became the Buddha's attendant. But the local king and villagers weren't so quick to accept Angulimala in this new light. And they asked the Buddha how he could defend such a miscreant with evil for his ideal. How could such a person have such virtue and restraint? The Buddha stood by Angulimala, asking the king to observe Angulimala's new, humble, monk-like behavior. And finally, the king was convinced that the murderous, bloody-handed Angulimala was transformed. The king went on his way saying, "It is wonderful, it is marvelous that one whom we could not subdue with punishment and weapons, the Blessed One has subdued without punishment or weapons." So this ends the first part of the story, but there is an epilogue. And I think it's an important one. Angulimala continued to live at the monastery and go out regularly for alms. He was diligent, ardent, and self-controlled. What had to be done was done. The venerable Angulimala became an arahant. That is, a person free of all defilements and fetters, and like the Buddha, who is not destined for further rebirth. Pretty amazing. From murderer to enlightened one in one lifetime. What is interesting is that he still lived with the consequences of his harmful actions. It's said that when he went out for alms, people sometimes threw rocks and sticks or pottery at him and wounded him. And he came to the Buddha bleeding. And when the Buddha saw this, he said to him, "Bear it, Brahman, bear it. You have experienced here and now in this life the ripening of deeds." Angulimala, it is said, exclaimed in response, "Who once did live in recklessness and then is reckless nevermore shall light the world like the full moon when clouds unmask it." There are some that tame with beatings, some with goads, and some with lashes. One who has neither rod nor weapon, I am tamed by, such as he. So Steve showed a picture of the Angulimala stupa that testifies to the importance of the message of Angulimala's story. It's a story that has always been meaningful to me because it validates the practice that we can always come back to the present moment and begin again. When we stray from the path of right action, we're not condemned. We do need to be aware of our unwholesome or harmful behavior. But creating elaborate stories powered by self-judgment and guilt will not move us forward to wholesomeness and harmlessness. This story reminds us also how important compassion and equanimity are. That the Buddha's path is transformative and redemptive. And the Buddha's The Buddha responded to Angulimala with equanimity and with compassion. He didn't react in horror or fear at his behavior. Buddha's calmness and clarity helped him to see through appearances to what Angulimala truly needed in order to transform. His compassion helped the Buddha understand that Angulimala was actually suffering himself because of the three poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion, which had taken root in him. Another theme in the story helps us to see how important right action is. The Buddha said very clearly, "I have stopped forever for swearing violence to every living being, but you have not, no restraint towards anything." There's another sutta called that asks us to contemplate the five recollections, and one of them is one about right action that I think pertains here. And that recollection that the Buddha asks us to contemplate is, "My actions are my only true belongings. I cannot avoid the consequences of my actions. My actions are the ground on which I stand." And kindness as an action and forgiveness as an action to ourselves and to our enemies lead the way forward. And that is the hopeful and positive, I think, redeeming message that helps us understand why people would build a stupa to Angulimala and to the Buddha's way of responding to Angulimala. So it's my hope that these two stories from the Buddha's life have shown you both the humanity and the spiritual nobility of this wise, very compassionate being, the Buddha. Maybe they have stimulated you to think about Buddha stories that are especially illuminating to you. And I hope you'll be inspired to look at some of our resources on the Sims website and find out more about the Buddha's life and teachings, and explore further.